At its head there rode a tall and evil shape, mounted upon a black horse, if horse it was, for it was huge and hideous, and its face was a frightful mask, more like a skull than a living head, and in the sockets of its eyes and its nostrils there burned a flame. The rider was robed all in black, and black was his lofty helm. Yet this was no ringwraith, but a living man. The lieutenant of the Tower of Barad-dûr he was, and his name is remembered in no tale, for he himself had forgotten it, and he said, "I am the Mouth of Sauron."
All right, Clifford, we are back again.
Indeed we are.
What are we doing tonight?
Tonight we have Chapter 10, Book 5, final chapter of the book, The Black Gate Opens.
This is kind of like the, this chapter's kind of shorter. Hopefully this should be a shorter episode, but with us, it probably won't. But hopefully this should be a shorter episode, kind of like how that last week... Before, actually, no, in high school you had finals. I forgot all about those. I thought you just have a Christmas party and that's it. All right, so like in grade school, when you're in eighth grade, you don't have finals, you just have a Christmas party. So it could kind of be like
sometimes
that.
Final week was a short week in high school.
We could say it's like, by the time this comes out, it'll probably be March. So we could say it's like spring break e week, you know, like right before spring break.
Okay.
So. I don't know. All right. What do we go over what the chapter's called?
Yeah. The Black Gate Opens. Bad.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. So, this was another good chapter. I thought it was a very good way to end the most epic book of Lord of the Rings and one of the most epic books of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot went on. Let's just jump into Cliff's notes, though. Why don't you just get us started? Get the ball rolling.
So... The newly combined army of Gondor marches out of Gondor with Aragorn and Gandalf at its head and makes its way across Osgiliath and into Ithilien. They pass the crossroads and glance upon a silent Morgul Vale before moving north along the main road to the Black Gate in the northwest corner of Mordor. Besides a small, easily averted orc ambush, all is silent until they reach the Black Gate. A messenger of Sauron presents Frodo's mithril cloak and Sam's dagger to Gandalf and Aragorn, who are grief-stricken but refuse the terms of surrender. In response, Sauron launches his attack, and the full force of Mordor emerges from the gate to surround the army of Gondor.
Oh, let's go. Let's go. All right. Feelings?
Do you think this is... I was thinking, it feels like kind of a procedural episode at the start. Like, we're hitting some, like, you know... The gears of the plot are kind of turning. There's not really a ton of intrigue, I think, until we get to the end.
Yeah.
But then it ends on, I feel like, one of the bigger cliffhangers in the whole series.
Definitely.
I don't know if I would. I don't know if I could say the biggest, but it's like, holy cow, you're just left hanging.
Yeah, because, well, I have a question about, like, kind of the working of the chapter itself, too.
What's that?
Because for the first part, they're just marching. Uh-huh. Do you think he just quickly... Because again, I've said this about other sections of Return of the King. It's like, if this was Fellowship, he would be dwelling on a lot of this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But here, he just streamlined it because is he realizing, hey, let's just finish this book. Come on. Like, we got to get here. Like, just be done. I don't know. Did you think that at all?
Kind of. But I also thought, we know that this is a stripped down version of our original Fellowship of the company.
Yeah.
And their purpose is, they've stated for themselves, is explicitly just the most epic decoy possible.
Right. No, right? But I'm saying, like, the walk over. Like, if this was the first book.
I know. Yeah. I'm saying, I think, like, they're kind of, like, they kind of the whole purpose of their mission is just like one little piece of the bigger puzzle.
Yeah.
So it's not like the true journey right now. This is technically just a distraction.
Yeah.
And I feel like he kind of had that in mind while writing it.
Yeah. So what you're saying too with the cliffhanger at the end, it's I think there's kind of a reason for that I want to go over in the middle of this episode. So
okay. Stay tuned.
But it starts off with who gets left behind?
Mary.
Ooh, not this time. He doesn't get to go this time, right?
He should be, and Gandalf tells him he should be happy, right?
I think it's right. Aragorn that tells him,
right? Oh, sorry, Aragorn. Because if we remember from two chapters back, right, Mary helped kill the chief Nazgul, which is a huge deal.
That was like four chapters back, Clifford.
Okay. Conceptually, two chapters back.
Yeah.
And he's been recovering.
Right.
We recall he passed out, seemed like he was almost near death, coma of some sort, and Aragorn helped heal him along with Faramir and Eowyn.
Right. So I like that it was realistic that, hey, you're not fit to fight. We're not going to cheesily put you here just because, you know, you're a main character. It's like, no. First of all, he wasn't actually supposed to be at the Minas Tirith battle. He had to sneak his way to that one anyways. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, nah, you don't get to pull it twice. And yeah, you just killed Chief Nazgul, so you're set for great deeds under your belt.
Mm-hmm.
You're not fit to fight. Pippin gets to represent the Shire, plus he's still got to try to match your accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And then if we fail at the Black Gate, you'll get your chance to fight again. But if we fail at the Black Gate, it also doesn't matter for all of us, you know, like the downer note that he puts on that, you know, but
right.
It's a bummer that Mary doesn't get to go, but it's also like, yeah, there's no way around it. There's no way he could be sent. Okay. So dating for this thing. So they set out March 18th. Dates going to become really important really fast. Okay. And so we want to keep track of this stuff. In this chapter, you can actually do it because they're all traveling together and there's not like suspense cliffhanger stuff. Besides that, we don't know what's going on with Frodo and Sam. The first day they get 5 miles past Osgiliath. Osgiliath is on the river. They cross the river, right? The next day, March 19th, they get to the crossroads. You know, the very same place Frodo, Sam, and Gollum were at when they saw the headless statue. And then there's a good quote. Do you want to read that? I think it's a paragraph.
Then Aragorn set trumpeters at each of the four roads that ran into the Ring of Trees, and they blew a great fanfare, and the heralds cried aloud. The lords of Gondor have returned, and all this land that is theirs they take back. The hideous orc head that was set upon the carven figure was cast down and broken in pieces, and the old king's head was raised and set in its place once more, still crowned with white and golden flowers, and men labored to wash and pare away all the foul scrolls that orcs had put upon the stone.
Very cool. Cool. I like that detail. I loved the scene in Two Towers when they came to the statue, so cool to see that gets a reprisal. So they contemplate.
On the way up here, they touch on it briefly, but why they're just marching along, right? We've gone from a few chapters back, full on battle with this giant Mordor host, and now they basically have a clear road in front of them. So what's the deal here? Is it safe to assume that after the battle in front of Minas Tirith, they successfully scattered all of the hosts of Mordor, either killed them or sent them into retreat, and now they're basically just marching across empty land?
Okay, so there's still that northern army that did scatter, the one that Rohan got around. So they scattered and went back, but they potentially haven't made it back to Mordor yet, and that comes up. Everybody else, they've already sent out scouts, and the whole Ithilien seems like clear. And it was clear, actually, the last time when Frodo and Sam were marching through it with Gollum. So it's kind of a similar thing there, where, like, right before a big battle, Sauron just, you know, calm before the storm, clears out all the people, or, like, has all the lands empty before he, like, unleashes, you know? Kind of seems like that's how he wants to do it. It creeps the hell out of him, as we're about to read. And I don't know, why waste some stragglers, I guess? I don't really know.
Right.
It also works for the plot. honestly. But, uh-huh. But it, yeah, so, well, so the next thing on their list, though, if you're going this way, is like, all right, they could go to Minas Morgul, right? But they don't for a couple reasons. Why not?
Well, yeah, because it's closer, right? Like, they're already there, and that's one of the two paths into Mordor that they could take.
Right. There's a back road. It's not the Frodo and Sam staircase way.
That's like the back road off the back road.
Yeah, that's like the... I guess it is like a shortcut. I don't know. You know, like the shortcut, how it's always short. It's like, oh, why is it called a shortcut? It's like, well, if it was the way, it would just be called the way, you know, if it was easy. but there's a road behind Minas Morgul that you can actually get into Mordor that way too.
Right, right.
So some of the people, leaders, somewhat think about it, but they don't because...
The valley is super evil, and they basically think that it'll drive the men in their army insane just being there.
Right.
It'll break apart their force just from the mental torture.
Right.
And then secondly,
more Gandalf importantly,
knows that Frodo went that way or kind of that way.
Yeah. And so, well, so the whole thing about that is like, they're trying to distract Sauron. And so by distract, you know, he's an eye and the eye can kind of see through anything, like, you know, clouds, the mountains, that doesn't really matter. So you literally don't want him looking at the way Frodo went, you know? Mm-hmm. So we're going to go north because Frodo cut straight east from here, you know? So we're going to go north and get, like, literally distract the eyesight, basically. Which is kind of weird to think about, but it's also like, I don't know. Yeah, that makes sense to me, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The only converse of that I could see is, like, there is... So far, there's been some, like, hiding in plain sight thing going on that's been working out. We hope has been working out for Frodo. And I could see some alternate version.
No way. Try
hiding in plain sight. But it totally
makes
sense.
That doesn't work with the ring and Sauron. Right,
right. If he's looking right at it or right past it, he'll probably notice it.
Yeah.
Plus, if they go north like they're planning to, it literally pulls orcs north out of... Morgul Vale, where they think Frodo is. Fewer bodies to deal with.
Yep. They do. Gandalf and Aragorn do ride up and look at the city, and they burn down the bridge there, and then they leave some archers, so they somewhat got it covered. The next day, March 20th, they march north, and then I said we should read something. I don't even know what we're going to read, but let's read it.
The day after, being the third day since they set out from Minas Tirith, the army began its northward march along the road. It was some 100 miles by that way from the crossroads to the Morannon, and what might befall them before they came so far none knew. They went openly but heedfully, with mounted scouts before them on the road and others on foot upon either side, especially on the eastward flank, for there lay dark thickets and a tumbled land of rocky gills and crags, behind which the long, grim slopes of the Ethel Dueth clambered up. The weather of the world remained fair, and the wind held in the west, but nothing could waft away the glooms and the sad mists that clung about the mountains of shadow, and behind them at whiles great smokes would arise and hover in the upper winds. Ever and anon Gandalf let blow the trumpets, and the heralds would cry, "The lords of Gondor are come! Let all leave this land or yield them up!" But Imrahil said, "Say not the lords of Gondor, say the King Elisar, for that is true, and even though he is not yet sat upon the throne, then it will give the enemy more thought if the heralds use that name." And thereafter, thrice a day, the heralds proclaimed the coming of the King Elisar, but none answered the challenge.
Ho ho, ho ho. All right, Imrahil being cool again. Low-key, great character. Shouldn't have been cut out of the movie, but what's done is done. Maybe he should have been cut out. I don't know. Anyways, he's cool in the book. Based on that description, I kind of read it like, all right, this is a weird balancing act between this is the glorious liberating army, you know, marching out to the climax of the story. But then at the same time, it's really gloomy because there's impending doom going on. You know, like feel it, right?
Also so interesting because they're totally bluffing here. It's kind of tricky. It's like they're kind of bluffing, but they actually have a decent army and they're taking it seriously. But they kind of also know that their army is an order of magnitude different than what it would actually need to be actually threatening to Sauron.
I think like so, an order of three magnitudes. Yeah.
Multiple orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
So in a way they need, these are like the hype men trying to ensure that they're as big of a deal as they can be in Sauron's mind. And so that's where Imrahil is making a good call. Because it's not really about the formality of proclaiming his Aragorn's kingship here. It's about creating as big of a presence, like holding up their arms and making themselves, puffing up their chests as big as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I like that they just take him up on that suggestion. It's like, oh, yeah, that is a smart idea. Yeah, like, because I don't know. Like, when you read this through the first time, and you're like, but and you've seen the movies, you're saying, oh, who's this guy? Like, what is he doing? And he's got kind of like weird lines, and he's got a bigger role and everything. But it's actually no. Like, if you give him a good chance, yeah, he's awesome. So, I enjoyed that one. All right, March 21st though. There is actually some minor ambush from orcs and Easterlings. They said it's right where Faramir had ambushed the Olyphants with Frodo and Sam there, you know. But Gondor was prepared for it. They handle it masterfully, so it wasn't that big a deal. Anything else about that one?
No, notably they recognized that it was just a feint by Sauron. They think Sauron, it's like they're kind of playing chess here, where they're testing each other, and they're trying to lure Sauron into a trap. Sauron thinks he's trying to lure them into a trap. So this was a meaningless ambush from both sides. It was just really, Sauron thought that he was inflating their sense of confidence in themselves to successfully trap the Black Gate.
Yeah, but it definitely didn't, because they all felt more nervous and gloomy after it, you know?
Right. Even though they dealt with it perfectly.
They also said the Nazgul are starting to fly high above, like out of sight, for all but Legolas, you know? Cool. Mm-hmm. Cool elf detail there. I assume the Sons of Elrond can see them too, even though Tolkien didn't mention them. Let's see. So they keep marching for 2 days. March 23rd, the army reaches the end of Ithilien, so that means they're coming to the Emmanuel, dead marshes, those slag heaps and everything. And some of the men are really frightened now. And so this is a good section here. I can take this one too.
Sure.
Aragorn looked at them, and there was pity in his eyes rather than wrath. For these were young men from Rohan, from the Westfold far away, or husbandmen from Lasarnach. And to them, Mordor had been, from childhood, a name of evil, and yet unreal, a legend that had no part in their simple life. And now they walked like men in a hideous dream, made true, and they understood not this war, nor why fate should lead them to such a pass. Go, said Aragorn, but keep what honor you may, and do not run. And there is a task which you may attempt, and so be not fully shamed. Take your way southwest, till you come to Cair Andros, and if that is still held by enemies, as I think, then retake it, if you can, and hold it to the last in defense of Gondor and Rohan. So Cair Andros is the island.
The waterfalls.
No. That's Heneth Anun. Cair Andros is an island in the middle of Anduin. It's like a huge, what'd we say those were? Islets?
Oh, yeah.
Old English word that we use? Eyot. Eyot.
Oh, right.
It's like
massive
eyots, to where it's like just a proper island.
Uh-huh.
In the middle of the Anduin. And so you can ford both sides of it, I think, and that's how the northern orc army had originally gotten into Gondor to block off the Rohan army riding, you know, that Théoden had to skirt around. So they retreated back to Cair Andros, too. If you want to look at a map, you'd probably see it, but we don't really have to do that.
No, it makes sense.
Yeah. All right, so Aragorn says, okay, those people that are kind of scared to do it, you guys can go that way. I mean, the Tolkien explicitly says it. Now they walked like men in a hideous dream made true. You know, they're walking into the childhood nightmare that they grew up with. So legends come to life, fairy tales come to life, as we've said before. This is, again, the inverse of it. Like, okay, no, we're walking into a nightmare, which is kind of creepy. But we already saw that with the ghost, too. That was similar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think, is there, like, how much of this ties back to Tolkien's war experience?
Oh, this? Yeah, this probably is. You're right.
I have to imagine that, like, there's all these men, a bunch of whom are like kind of fresh from Gondor, marching together. It all seems good. And then hitting the Dead Marshes is basically like the trenches.
Yeah. Well, we said the Dead Marshes. Europe. Right. We said the marshes are the marshes are like the trenches when Frodo and Sam were going through it, and all the dead bodies were in the mud and everything, you know?
Right, right.
In the swamp. So, yeah, definitely. But this is, yeah, there's probably an aspect like, okay, we're leaving green fields of France, green fields of England behind, and now we're in the trenches.
And so, yeah, some portion of the army is just like immediately heartbroken,
crestfallen. Right. I thought it was slightly strange that they, because if you lived in Gondor and Rohan for the past two generations, I feel like you must have fought an orc at some point, you know?
Maybe.
But I guess there is a difference between fighting the orcs on your own territory versus walking into their kind of domain, you know?
Right, right.
Like, I get that. Also,
what he's describing, like, if they're buried in, if these men are from, like, way out in Rohan or the southern reaches of Gondor or something, they may never have seen an orc, right?
Well, no, that's what I'm thinking, because, they fought evil men, at least. The South Gondor, because the ships, you know, like, they were fighting all the ship people constantly, like the Haradrim and stuff, so maybe not orcs, but they've seen evil people, and they fought evil people. So, same with Rohan with the Dunlendings,
you know? Right, right. Okay, fair enough.
I don't know. The other thing, too, these guys are all starting to quake in their boots, and they got all the fearless leaders with them and everything.
Uh-huh.
It's crazy to think Frodo and Sam have already passed through all this stuff, and this was just one of the many hurdles they had to do. Right. You know, it's pretty wild. But so credit, as you read them backtrack Frodo and Sam's step, it's really credit to Frodo and Sam for already passing all this crazy stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so they keep going though. Journey another day. This is the March 24th. They spend a creepy night's sleep in the wastelands with like some watchfires around, but it's like, I don't know. Oh, you know what? This is just, this is an interesting fact. I totally don't need to say it, but I will. You know how like kids always say they're scared of the dark and everything?
Uh-huh.
Or like a monster's under their bed?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, that's probably a primordial instinct, because like, when it was just, you know, cavemen or like sleeping out in the wilderness like this, it's like, all right, something in the dark, there probably was a monster in the dark.
Right, right.
It's like, oh, that's probably how they felt that night as they were sleeping out there. But yeah, just an FYI, yeah. So anyways, then we get to March 25th, right? Okay, wind is coming out of the north, so I guess it's with them because they would have gotten far enough north that now they're turning south to face the Black Gate.
They kind of skirted, they made a little bit of a wider turn than they needed to, because they thought cutting the corner would put them in dangerous territory where they'd be surrounded by these hills where they know there's bad people hiding out.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so they arrive at the Black Gate, and then
the two vast iron doors of the Black Gate under its frowning arch were fast closed. Upon the battlement nothing could be seen. All was silent but watchful. They were come to the last end of their folly, and stood forlorn and chill in the gray light of early days before towers and walls which their army could not assault with hope, not even if it had brought thither engines of great power, and the enemy had no more force than would suffice for the manning of the gate and wall alone. Yet they knew that all the hills and rocks about the Morannon were filled with hidden foes, and the shadowy defile beyond was bored and tunneled by teeming broods of evil things. And as they stood, they saw all the Nazgul gathered together, hovering above the towers of the Teeth like vultures, and they knew that they were watched. But still the enemy made no sign.
Ho ho ho. Ho ho ho. All right. Go on.
Yes. This, just to what we were saying earlier, Tolkien straight up refers to this as a folly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, which I thought that's was what I was gonna bring up.
Yeah,
that's not just like, oh, it's a diversion, but full-on folly, which implies, you know, like a fool's errand.
I thought it was it reminded me of the last chapter where Gandalf had basically said the same thing about their plan, like, in our great wisdom or in our folly, you know, we've sent the ring into Mordor, you know, and for something so climactic and so important, there is no difference. like this is like it's kind of so much kind of providential destiny. And then also, like, yeah, we're freely willing to take this on and everything. That it's like, yeah, there's no difference there. I don't know. We kind of talked about
right.
That
there's no chapter. Decent. There's no like decent average option.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
For practical purposes, this is complete suicide, but this is also the most selfless, brave, good thing we can do for everybody in Middle Earth. So we're doing it, you know, even though this is dumb. So, yeah.
And then very definitively Tolkien lays out that even if they had a way more powerful army than they do have, and the army and the enemy, Sauron, had basically no force behind the gate, just by the nature of how strong this wall is, how good of a fortress this is, they still wouldn't stand a chance.
Right. That's why I was saying three magnitudes, you know. Like one is not enough by any means. But yeah. All right. Okay, so real quick before we get into the climax of this chapter, and I mean really quick, I did skim all the draft notes of most of book 5 because we haven't talked about this because like the episodes were too big. When he wrote The Siege of Gondor, so chapter 4, he kind of started outlining what he wanted to do for the rest of the book, and he got a lot of it. But there's a couple things where it's just fun to note him. He had a hard time figuring out how he's going to get married to Minas Tirith. You know, like, yeah, sure, you could go with Eowyn, but like, how's he going to hide, you know, with the army and everything?
Mm-hmm.
And like, basically they treated him like a bag, you know, that was kind of the solution, the overt solution. And he was, he had the battle plan and Aragorn coming on the ships and everything, but he was actually tentatively going to say Aragorn's going to meet Denethor and it's going to be a cold, awkward encounter and everything. But so like the idea that Denethor dies in the pyre with the Palantir was kind of a late idea.
Mm.
It seems like the House of the Healing was also a late idea. There was some last stuff about recounting Aragorn's journey, that last debate chapter, and then this march to Mordor. It took a while for him to fit it together, but the ideas were all essentially there. But it all led up to what we're about to read. And this, in the broadest strokes of this, he basically had since he's been writing, like, The Siege of Gondor. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of cool. Mm. So, like, you know, when I got to that chapter of the drafts, it was like a page because he's like, yeah, he basically got it in one shot. You know? So we're about to read. It's like, yep, he was just rolling by this point, you know, and he knew, like you said, he knew what cliffhanger he was building up to. So, yeah. All right, should we do it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Aragorn, he sends an embassy up to the Black Gate that includes himself and every other major character that we've covered. And what does he say here? I guess I'll take Aragorn. I guess I gotta be Aragorn. Come forth, they cried. Let the Lord of the Black Land come forth. Justice shall be done upon him. For wrongfully has he made war upon Gondor and wrested its lands. Therefore, the King of Gondor demands that he should atone for his evils, and depart then forever. Come forth.
There was a long silence, and from wall and gate no cry or sound was heard in answer. But Sauron had already laid his plans, and he had a mind first to play these mice cruelly before he struck to kill. So it was that even as the captains were about to turn away, the silence was broken suddenly. There came a long rolling of great drums like thunder in the mountains, then a braying of horns that shook the very stones and stunned men's ears. And thereupon the door of the Black Gate was thrown open with a great clang, and out of it there came an embassy from the Dark Tower. At its head there rode a tall and evil shape, mounted upon a black horse, if horse it was, for it was huge and hideous, and its face was a frightful mask, more like a skull than a living head, and in the sockets of its eyes and its nostrils there burned a flame. The rider was robed all in black, and black was his lofty helm. Yet this was no ringwraith, but a living man. The lieutenant of the Tower of Barad-dûr he was, and his name is remembered in no tale, for he himself had forgotten it. And he said, I am the Mouth of Sauron. But it is told that he was a renegade, who came of the race of those that are named the Black Numenoreans, for they established their dwellings in Middle-earth during the years of Sauron's domination, and they worshipped him, being enamored of evil knowledge. And he entered the service of the Dark Tower when it rose first again, and because of his cunning he grew ever higher in the Lord's favor, and he was learned cruel sorcery, and knew much of the mind of Sauron, and he was more cruel than any orc.
All right, where do you want to start with that?
So, Sauron seems to be, in a way, playing into their... Well, it's hard to say who's playing who here, but Sauron clearly says he's going to play these mice cruelly before he kills them. In other words, he knows that they're completely outnumbered, and he has the upper hand by orders of magnitude. However, instead of a tactically effective strategy of just leaving the doors closed and letting them sit there, which would leave the good guys basically completely out of luck in our situation, he decides he's going to mess with them. And yeah. So this the purpose of this guy going out, we know, is to inflict emotional damage, basically.
Right. All right. Well, what do we think of this guy? Black Numenorean. So we know about them, right? Because we've done the Numenor specials, right? Who would these guys be?
These are the ones who would have started worshipping Sauron when he smuggled himself onto Numenor and emerged there.
Potentially, right? or they had the settlements, like the colonies, on Middle Earth anyways. So when Numenor was destroyed, those colonies weren't destroyed because they were in Middle Earth. Stayed bad guys. But it could have been either way. Yeah, I mean, who knows?
No, you're right, because for they established their dwellings in Middle Earth during the years of Sauron's domination. Okay.
Yeah.
So weirdly, this guy could be distantly related to Aragorn.
Correct.
But of basically opposite lineage in a way.
Yeah. He's definitely, I mean, yeah, both of them are descendants.
Aragorn could be staring at like the inverse, the contrapositive of himself in the
mirror. Right, right. Yeah, so I don't know. So this is in the extended edition of the movie. Like, they have this guy in the extended edition of Return of the King. So if you, I think they did a pretty good job with how he looked and spoke there. Like, that was pretty interesting. But there's quite a few things they get wrong with that scene, I would say, as we'll go over. But more cruel than any orc, this guy kind of made Gollum sound kind of wholesome, you know, for somebody that's corrupt, because there's flames in his eyes. And then I think most scariest of all, in Tolkien-esque detail, he had forgotten his own name. So that's creepy on its face. But then Fleming Rutledge takes it here. So she says, when we remember that in Genesis, the creator gives Adam the derivative gift of naming the animals, and the patriarchs and matriarchs of Israel were given names denoting their special calling, and that Jesus, the Son of God, was made a particular point of calling people by name, we may rightly designate this is the ultimate dehumanization, aka that this guy doesn't even have his own name. And when we think about Tolkien, especially Tolkien, philology nerd, it's like, oh my gosh, for him to like not have a name for this guy, I mean, that's unheard of. So it's like, that's such a big deal here that he was just abandoned. It's like the other thing she even mentions, like the battering ram in Minas Tirith had a name, his name Grond. Right. But then this guy can't even remember his own name. It's crazy. Like, that's how intertwined and
right, he's fully subsumed himself to Sauron's will.
Yeah. It's like, all right, he's in a position of power, but, I mean, he's more enslaved than anybody, than most, 99.9% of people all time. She says as well, though he is puffed up and bombastic, nothing could be more lacking in true honor or power than his office, for there is nothing left of him except craven civility. This, by extension, is true of all who hope to gain status by serving tyrants. They lose themselves in the process. That kind of sums up pretty well, better than what anything we could say. So he comes out. He's the mouth of Sauron, so obviously we're going to have a conversation. All right, well, hold on. We got to decide who's going to be this guy and who's going to be the good guys.
I can be the bad guy.
Ooh. All right, Clifford, I'll let you take it.
Check.
Okay. He it was that now rode out, and with him came only a small company of black-harnessed soldiery and a single banner, black, but bearing on it, in red, the evil eye. Now halting a few paces before the captains of the West, he looked them up and down and laughed.
"Is there anyone in this rout with authority to treat with me?" he asked. "Or indeed with wit to understand me? Not thou, at least," he mocked, turning to Aragorn with scorn. "It needs more to make a king than a piece of elvish glass or a rabble such as this. Why, any brigand of the hills can show as good a following."
Aragorn said naught in answer, but he took the other's eye and held it, and for a moment they strove thus. But soon, though Aragorn did not stir nor move hand to weapon, the other quailed and gave back as if menaced with a blow.
"I am a herald and ambassador, and may not be assailed," he cried.
"Where such laws hold," said Gandalf, "it is also the custom for ambassadors to use less insolence. But no one has threatened you. You have naught to fear from us until your errand is done. But unless your master has come to new wisdom, then with all his servants you will be in great peril."
"So," said the messenger, "then thou art the
spokesman." Hold on. I think that's how far we want to get. Okay, so that's how far we want to go for now. So Aragorn wins the stare down contest. Sick. Yeah, as we already said, the mind and the will of this guy are becoming, with Sauron, are very intertwined, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? I guess we didn't really need too much of a break, but Aragorn won the stare down.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
No.
Okay. All right. Then let's just jump into it.
"So," said the messenger, "then thou art the spokesman, old Greybeard? Have we not heard of thee at whiles and of thy wanderings, ever hatching plots and mischief at a safe distance? But this time thou hast stuck out thy nose too far, Master Gandalf, and thou shalt see what comes to him who sets his foolish webs before the feet of Sauron the Great. I have tokens that I was bidden to show thee, to thee in the special, if thou shouldest dare to come." He signaled back to one of his guards, and he came forward bearing a bundle swathed in black cloths.
The messenger put these aside, and there was, to the wonder and dismay of all the captains, he held up first the short sword that Sam had carried, and next a gray cloak with an elven brooch, and last the coat of mithril mail that Frodo had worn wrapped in his tattered garments. A blackness came before their eyes, and it seemed to them in a moment of silence that the world stood still. But their hearts were dead and their last hope gone. Pippin, who stood behind Prince Imrahil, sprang forward with a great cry of grief. "Silence," said Gandalf sternly, thrusting him back. But the messenger laughed aloud.
"So you have yet another of these imps with you," he cried. "What use you find in them, I cannot guess. But to send them as spies into Mordor is beyond even your accustomed folly. Still, I thank him, for it is plain that this brat at least has seen these tokens before, and it would be vain for you to deny them now."
"I do not wish to deny them," said Gandalf. "Indeed, I know them all and all their history, and despite your scorn, foul mouth of Sauron, you cannot say as much. But why do you bring them here?"
"Dwarf coat, elf cloak, blade of the downfallen west, and spy from the little ratland of the Shire. Nay, do not start. We know it well. Here are the marks of a conspiracy. Now, maybe he that bore these things was a creature that you would not grieve to lose, and maybe otherwise, one dear to you, perhaps? If so, take swift counsel with what little wit is left to you, for Sauron does not love spies, and what his fate shall be depends now on your choice."
No one answered him, but he saw their faces gray with fear and the horror in their eyes, and he laughed again, for it seemed to him that his sport went well.
"Good, good," he said. "He was dear to you, I see. Or else his errand was one that you did not wish to fail? It has. And now he shall endure the slow torment of years, as long and slow as our arts in the great tower can contrive, and never be released, until unless maybe he is changed and broken, so that he may come to you and you shall see what you have done. This shall surely be unless you accept my lord's terms."
"Name the terms," said Gandalf steadily, but those nearby saw anguish in his face, and now he seemed an old and wizened man, crushed, defeated at last. They did not doubt that he would accept. Okay, what do we think here?
This is total curveball here, at least for me, because we knew that this is a folly, it's all kind of a game, they're trying to distract attention, but it's completely contingent
right.
Frodo getting by unscathed, right?
Right.
And there is no better proof besides Frodo's body, maybe, than the mithril cloak that they could give that they have Frodo.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that they've done something to him.
Right. So, but there's more going on here because we've read book four, the characters right. haven't. Right. So I don't know if this is like fourth wall irony or like, I don't think it's fourth wall, but anyways, it's like the highest kind of irony where the audience knows something that the characters don't.
Exactly.
So yeah. it would actually kind of be good if we went over, what does the messenger / Sauron know? What does uh-huh. Gandalf and company know? And what do we, the audience, know?
That's good. Okay.
Okay. So the messenger, what does he know?
The messenger knows that they found two hobbits.
Whoa.
Oh, no, okay. Whoa. The messenger knows that they found a hobbit.
A spy who is a hobbit, yeah.
Yeah.
Captured or, in no, the tower.
I should say, they don't actually know this. The spy is conjecture. They know that they found a hobbit near Cirith Ungol.
Yep.
And they took from him a sword, a cloak, and the mithril cloak.
Right.
The messenger hasn't actually seen this hobbit, right? This is all transmitted orc to orc, right? This has been passed along physically.
There might be a Nazgul message somewhere in there, but yeah.
Okay. Anyways, little game of telephone.
Right.
They found a hobbit near Cirith Ungol. The messenger thinks it's a spy because that's what Sauron assumed.
Yeah, and it's, we don't really, I don't think we can pick up any idea that the messenger / Sauron has any idea why this spy was here the whole right. time. That's the thing.
Right.
Okay. All right. So then what does Gandalf know based on everything that he's seen?
Gandalf, I think, sees that the mithril cloak in particular knows that like Frodo wouldn't part with that unless he was captured and it was stripped off of his limp body.
Right.
Which we know is basically what happened. So Gandalf knows that they've captured Frodo in some way.
Yeah,
but he seems to be, if we can read his emotions later on well enough, it seems like he's gathering from what the messenger is saying that they don't know about Frodo's intentions.
Right. Okay. And then we as the audience know
that Frodo was captured.
Yeah, Frodo was captured. What else?
Sam was not captured. So Sauron doesn't know about Sam. They don't have the ring and they don't know about the ring.
Yeah, Sam. Well, what did Sam take with him? Sam took with him the ring.
Uh-huh.
He took with him the file of Galadriel because they didn't present that, and he took with him Sting because remember, Sting was Frodo's good sword. Sam left his lesser sword with Frodo, and that's what they just presented to the Fellowship there.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pippin kind of did at least break like, oh shoot, like they got one of them, or they got somebody that I know, like I recognize all that stuff, right? But they potentially have not pieced it together that there's two. And then we also don't know the whole status of Frodo too. So there is still the cliffhanger part completely where, okay, last we checked, Frodo's trapped in a tower. Sam's trying.
Was preparing to bust in.
Right. But he got knocked out. Yeah. Anyways, obviously this is a super deflating point for what you're saying because past two chapters in particular, but really all of book five has hinged on distracting this so that Frodo can get through, distracting Sauron completely so that Frodo can just make it to Mordor and finish the job, right?
Right.
And that seems to have failed.
And with, the basic assumption that if anything happens to Frodo, like if anything goes wrong with that plan, that he's helpless.
Right.
He's not strong enough to defend himself. The only way the plan of Frodo destroying the ring can work is if he gets by completely under the radar.
Yeah.
There's not a version where he has to fight his way through to the tower.
Yeah.
To Barad-dûr.
And so then the last thing that I read, it seems everybody's looking at Gandalf and the way he said, name the terms, seems they said they did not doubt that he would accept. Mm-hmm. And so I believe you said you got a certain epic reading that starts here.
Indeed I do.
Okay. All right. I got to listen to it.
Okay. These are the terms, said the messenger, and smiled as he eyed them one by one. The rabble of Gondor and its deluded allies shall withdraw at once beyond the Anduin, first taking oaths never again to assail Sauron the Great in arms, open or secret. All lands east of the Anduin shall be Sauron's forever, solely. West of the Anduin, as far as the Misty Mountains and the Gap of Rohan, shall be tributary to Mordor, and men there shall bear no weapons, but shall have leave to govern their own affairs. But they shall help to rebuild Isengard, which they have wantonly destroyed. And that shall be Sauron's, and there his lieutenant shall dwell, not Saruman, but one more worthy of trust. Looking in the messenger's eyes, they read his thought. He was to be that lieutenant, and gather all that remained of the West under his sway. He would be their tyrant and they his slaves. But Gandalf said, "There is much to demand for the delivery of one servant, that your master should receive in exchange for what must else fight a war to gain. Or has the field of Gondor destroyed his hope in war so that he falls to haggling? And if indeed we rated this prisoner so high, what surety have we that Sauron, the base master of treachery, will keep his part? Where is this prisoner? Let him be brought forth and yielded to us, and then we will consider these demands." It seemed then to Gandalf, intent, watching him as a man engaged in fencing with a deadly foe, that for the taking of a breath the messenger was at a loss, yet swiftly he laughed again. "Do not bandy words in your insolence with the mouth of Sauron," he cried. "Surety you crave, Sauron gives none. If you sue for his clemency, you must first do his bidding. These are his terms. Take them or leave them." "These we will take," said Gandalf suddenly. He cast aside his cloak, and a white light shone forth like a sword in that black place. Before his upraised hand, the foul messenger recoiled, and Gandalf, coming, seized and took from him the tokens, coat, cloak, and sword. "These we will take in memory of our friend," he cried. "But as for your terms, we reject them utterly. Get you gone, for your embassy is over and death is near to you. We did not come here to waste words in treating with Sauron, faithless and accursed, still less with one of his slaves. Begone!" Then the messenger of Mordor laughed no more. His face was twisted with amazement and anger to the likeness of some wild beast that, as it crouches on its prey, is smitten on the muzzle with a stinging rod. Rage filled him and his mouth slavered, and shapeless sounds of fury came strangling from his throat. But he looked at the fell faces of the captains and their deadly eyes, and fear overcame his wrath. He gave a great cry and turned, leaped upon his steed, and with his company galloped madly back to Kirith Gorgor. But as they went, his soldiers blew their horns in signal long arranged, and even before they came to the gate, Sauron sprang his trap.
Oh, Clifford, you went for it all.
Yeah. Sorry if I took too much fun.
No, yeah, well, we're actually going to have some overlap, because I started further down than you, but yeah. Okay, all right. So you did it all. So let's analyze it first here a little bit.
Or should we listen? Should we listen to yours?
No,
or yours go further?
Mine goes further. Yeah. So okay. that's the thing. All right. So let's analyze this first. Excellent job, by the way. I think that was.
Thank you very much.
It was potentially your best, in my opinion.
Ooh. So, ooh.
Got it on the last round, because we're not doing this for book six.
Okay.
It's not as epic. There's just not as many things to do it for. So. all right. So what do we think of the terms?
I think designed to be totally shocking, like completely unfair. But on the other hand, it was actually it's made it sound less terrible than I expected.
Right. That's the thing. It's weird. It's demanding, but also conceding.
Right. It's like you actually get like some, you don't get to, it's like you're clearly subservient, but you get to govern yourself in some way. And it sounds like if you're like a lowly person, you get to keep your day-to-day life as long as you're paying tributary to this lord up above.
Yeah, and if you outnumber this army by magnitudes, why are you offering them anything besides? The Shire and all of Eriador, like from Rivendell on, theoretically that should just not even be under Saruman's influence even. So, I mean,
right.
It's like, what? You're going to let somebody go free, like, completely? They could have armies there. I mean, that's crazy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It sounds like, everything we've been hearing about the armies of Mordor sweeping over Gondor, we assume that Sauron just wants to, like, burn the entire world to the ground. And here he's like, this sounds almost like political. This is like a political treaty. Like, you put this border here, and then you're going to do this. You're going to swear fealty here. It's way less fire and ruin than I expected.
Well, I thought that might have been a applicability moment. Like, you know, in Tolkien's own day, the Allied leadership in the 30s was just giving concessions to Hitler. You know, like, if he asked for something, it's like, all right, fine, we'll do it. And Tolkien, you know, this is a subtle... No, stop. Right. Like, that didn't work out. That wasn't good. We're not doing it now, you know, because Gandalf was like, hell no, we're rejecting this.
I have another theory, though, also.
Oh, go for it.
Which is that had the messenger come out and been like, the terms are we kill all of you right here and destroy everything you know. There's no chance that they would agree to that, even if it was a feasible outcome for Mordor, like they're capable of doing that battle-wise. But for the messenger to come out and offer something that's like faint, like very faintly palatable, if you're not Aragorn or Gandalf or something, it's a way to strike like a note of unsurety or like disconfidence, right, in the lower, all the lower, like mid to low tier people,
yeah,
who might be hearing it, because they might say to themselves like, hey, I have a lord above me anyways, like what's the big deal,
right?
If I can go back to my homeland, do I really need to fight for this right now?
Right. So it looked like Gandalf was, you know, they said, oh, it looks like he's going to accept the terms. Then again, they did a similar thing with Saruman at Isengard. Like, it looked like Gandalf would go join him or something. You know, they said a similar thing. But Gandalf, as ever, he uses singular prisoner idea, even though everybody on the good side knows two people went in there. And so, you know, he demands to see Frodo. Like, he calls their bluff. Which, like what you said, it's like, all right, Aragorn's army, like they are bluffing the whole time. Like, they don't have the ring. But then Gandalf's now calling the messenger's bluff too. It's like, all right, let's see him. And then there was that line, for the taking of a breath, the messenger was at a loss. Like, oh, I don't have an answer to this. You can't see this guy, right? So I don't know. It's kind of poker within poker, you know?
Right. Also, yeah, clearly the messenger thought that him revealing the mithril cloak and everything was like the ultimate blow,
right,
to the good guys. He thought that was going to be the final word, and they were going to be speechless, and the day was wrapped up. So the fact that he's so shocked that Gandalf is rejecting his terms that he hadn't even thought that far ahead.
It seems like I don't know. It does seem like Gandalf just picked up, all right, maybe you got one of them. You don't have two, from what it sounds like. So would Gandalf, if they had said, okay, we got both Frodo and Sam by name, do you think they would just fight on, or would they have, like, given in? I mean, they've come so far, you know? I think, like, they already know, like, hey, we're fighting either way.
Yeah.
No matter what.
I think they know they have to fight either way.
That's the Northern courage.
Also, whatever anything they're hearing from Saruman, or from Sauron, rather, it's not, even though we know that we didn't get the same warning like we did before talking to Saruman, I think it's safe to assume that any words they're hearing can be totally treacherous. Like, it could be complete lies,
right,
that are,
yeah,
somehow being spun for their ears. And Gandalf, I think, probably knows that the enemy could have somehow figured out some trickery to tell them the names, even if they didn't have them.
Yeah. And like Aragorn, I don't know, especially in the last chapter, he said, like, I'm not sheathing this sword until we see this through. You know, I mean, yeah, it's like, all right, he's not going to give in. They didn't come this far. Even if they said Frodo and Sam, like, they showed him Frodo and Sam's dead bodies, they would still fight at that point, I think. And maybe at that point, they hope somebody else has the ring and destroys it. I don't know, you know. But let's see. With that, let's jump into
Fearless.
Yeah, let's jump into my epic recording. It starts halfway through Clifford's, but then I extend it.
Okay.
These are his terms. Take them or leave them. These we will take, said Gandalf suddenly. He cast aside his cloak, and a white light shone forth like a sword in the black place. Before his upraised hand, the foul messenger recoiled, and Gandalf, coming, seized and took from him the tokens, coat, cloak, and sword. These we will take in memory of our friend, he cried. But as for your terms, we reject them utterly. Get you gone, for your embassy is over and death is near to you. We did not come here to waste words in the treating with Sauron, faithless and accursed. Still less with one of his slaves. Begone! Then the messenger of Mordor laughed no more. His face was twisted with amazement and anger to the likeness of some wild beast that, as it crouches on its prey, is smitten on the muzzle with a stinging rod. Rage filled him, and his mouth slavered, and shapeless sounds of fury came strangling from his throat. But he looked on the fell faces of the captains and their deadly eyes, and fear overcame his wrath. He gave a great cry, and turned, and leaped upon his steed, and with his company galloped madly back to Cirith Gorgor. But as they went, his soldiers blew their horns and signal long arranged, and even before they came to the gate, Sauron sprang his trap. Drums rolled and fires leaped. The great doors of the Black Gate swung back wide. Out of it streamed a great host, as swiftly as swirling waters when its sluice is lifted. The captains mounted again and rode back, and from the host of Mordor there went up a jeering yell. Dust rose, smothering the air, as from nearby there marched up an army of Easterlings that had waited for the signal in the shadow of Ered Luthi beyond the further tower. Down from the hills on either side of the Morannon poured orcs innumerable. The men of the west were trapped, and soon, all about the gray mounds where they stood, forces 10 times, and more than 10 times their match, would bring them in a sea of enemies. Sauron had taken the proffered bait and jaws of steel. Little time was left to Aragorn for the ordering of his battle. Upon the one hill he stood with Gandalf, and there, fair and desperate, he raised the banner of the Tree and Stars. Upon the other hill, hard by, stood the banners of Rohan and Dol Amroth, White Horse and Silver Swan. And about each hill a ring was made facing all ways, bristling with spears and sword. But in the front towards Mordor, where the first bitter assault would come, there stood the sons of Elrond, on the left, with the Dúnedain about them, and on the right, the Prince Imrahil, with men of Dol Amroth tall and fair, and picked men of the Tower Guard. The wind blew, and the trumpets sang, and arrows whined, but the sun now climbing towards the south was veiled in the reeks of Mordor, and through a threatening haze it gleamed, remote, a sullen red, as if it were the ending of the day, or the end, maybe, of all the world of light. And out of the gathering murk the Nazgul came, with their cold voices crying words of death, and then all hope was quenched.
Nice.
Thanks.
Nice all work. Right.
All right, so I chose this one for a couple reasons. First of all, I wanted to get it because it started off with highlighting Gandalf. All right, so this whole time they kept referring to the mouth of Sauron as the messenger, right? And opposite him is Gandalf. And this whole time, in Lord of the Rings, for centuries, operating kind of in the periphery of Middle-earth, you know, where nobody can really notice him and helping all the good forces, you know, he's been a messenger this whole time, right?
Mm.
And he's been sent from where?
From Valinor, right?
Yeah, across the sea, right? Yeah, so he is a messenger himself, you know, and he's meeting Sauron's messenger here. Across the sea, and what's the Greek word for messenger? Do you know?
I knew at one point in time.
Oh, yeah, we talked about it. But Hazley talked about it because I didn't want to reveal this until, I guess, now. But
I don't know. What is it?
Angelos. So that is where we get angel.
Like angel.
Yeah, so that is where angel comes from. You know, like, well, messenger, so Gabriel. Guardian angel, archangel, you know, that appears with the message. But anyways, that is what he's supposed to be. Like, Gandalf is, you know, especially when it says here, like, all right, he took off his cloak and he shone forth, like, super white against, like, this whole black backdrop and everything. It's like, yes, this is the angel that has been sent to help everybody in Middle-earth this whole time, you know? He's no longer the shadowy gray Gandalf the Gray, right? Mm-hmm. You know, he's gleaming white since the turn of the tide when he showed up in Two Towers, turn of the tide. It's like, all right, now I'm openly leading all the good forces. You know, Aragorn even said to Éomer and Imrahil, it's like, all right, but really Gandalf's the commander-in-chief, right? You know?
Right.
It's like he's leading all the good forces, Rohan, Gondor. He's kind of like Saint Michael in my eyes almost, you know? like the angel, right? Like leading all the forces. So I don't know. I thought that was cool. And still, you know, he still dares to call the bluff here at the end. And it's like, yep, we're doing it. We're fighting. And then I thought about just stopping there, just like where you had stopped. Mm-hmm. But I said, no, let's roll with it because this happens much quicker than it does in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So like it says Sauron, you know, they ran back to the gates and then Sauron sprang his trap, and that almost made me think like mousetrap, like he already used the mouse analogy,
right?
But like
right.
mousetrap, but then also like Rube Goldberg machine, you know, like all the crazy things, like it's like all this stuff starts happening right away,
right?
And so like I don't know, the movie gets a couple things wrong. What they get really wrong is Aragorn in the movie, in the extended edition, cuts off the mouth of Sauron's head.
Right.
So he's like, all right, well, no, that's not kingly. Like, I don't accept. It's not good. And then they add in his speech. So Aragorn doesn't actually give a speech. I don't know. I thought the speech was actually a good, fine addition for the movie. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree.
I think I liked it. But, like, I like what the book does more, where this stuff all just comes crashing down really quick.
Yeah, the book actually is like, sounds like it happens so fast, right, that I think they would struggle to represent it accurately in the movie. Like, it would appear wrong from a cinematic point of view, because it'd be like a scene would change and suddenly they would be surrounded by a giant army.
I think how the movie could have done it, not that I'm a cinematographer or anything, but I would say you got to go like first person view, and okay, like all of a sudden it's like literally, think like a tsunami of evil forces just unleashed, uh-huh, like from the gates and from the hills on the sides and everything. Uh-huh. But the way the movie did it, it was like some aerial view where they start surrounding the good army, and the good army's in this huge circle, and it's like, uh-huh, I guess that's fine and that's actually kind of accurate, but that's not as intimidating. And then you still, like, you let up and give Aragorn time to give a speech, which, again, I get. But mm-hmm, this is better, because this is really, like, hell unleashed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's happens quick, and, like, let's go. Like, you know, we're just thrown right into it at the climax,
yeah,
here.
Yeah.
I guess that's kind of like, I don't know, maybe that would be reminiscent of a war experience, like a charge into battle or something, but...
Yeah. Yeah, it also feels like of the major battles we've seen, I'm thinking like Helm's Deep and then Minas Tirith, Pelennor Fields. It's like each one, like it starts out with like a huge epic setup and so much tension building, and then the, yeah, attack starts, and then this long attack, and it's like, mm, each one gets faster and faster.
Yeah.
And this is like complete caffeine rush. Like,
right,
the attack instantly starts. Do you think that's Tolkien like trying to, he's like, all right, I'm ready to be done, or I'm ready to move this along, or is it intentional that it keeps picking up?
So that's the thing, like when you read the books, is compared to the movies, I think you're bummed how much action there's not in the books compared to the movies. But that totally works for the book, because it's like, all right, does he really need to describe a hand-to-hand combat sword fight? I mean, like, I read fantasy books, and it's like, I can't keep up with this. Like, I'm not following the motions here. It's like, it really is, when you read the book at least, it really is all about the build-up, you know, like, or like, really just get my heart pumping, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, this does it. And then the fighting, like, well, see, he strategically puts his chapter ends so that he doesn't have to just go, like, describe a hand-to-hand combat thing. He can kind of just like the way he strategically does it, like, if you know, we've done it all book five, it's like, all right, the Nazgul is going to come into the gate, but then they hear the horns of Rohan, so it's like, oh, let's jump to that, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like Rohan, they're charging in, oh, all right, actually that one they did just jump straight back to Théoden, and he described it a little bit, but they honestly could have jump to even Denethor if they wanted to there, you know? So right, it's like, right, he like strategically breaks it up so that he doesn't have to describe all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good and that works. And then this is like, I don't know, the kind of the crowning achievement or the culmination of that or mm-hmm, something, mm-hmm, you know? So I thought it was good. I really liked it, but we're not even done yet. We still mm-hmm. got, after this was the one thing about this chapter too. If the narrator ever gets like totally omniscient, this is kind of the time, would be this chapter. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like he focused in on one character's perspective or anything. It was just the narrator. But they ended by zooming in on the lowliest character in attendance.
Mm-hmm.
Pippin, he starts to understand Denethor's nihilism a little bit, but he does regain his courage, and he figures out, okay, last actions of my life here. I got to be courageous. I got to do it. I love the detail that he's like, all right, I'm going to stand in front because it'll just get over quicker. Because honestly, I swear to God, I can relate. Like, I would do it for that exact same reason. Like, I would uh-huh. not be brave standing in the front. It's like, let me just stand in the front so we're done. Uh-huh. You know? But I think we should read this too. You want to start it?
Sure. Pippin had bowed, crushed with horror, when he heard Gandalf reject the terms and doom Frodo to the torment of the tower. But he had mastered himself, and now he stood beside Beregrond, in the front rank of Gondor with Imrahil's men. For it seemed best to him to die soon and leave the bitter story of his life, since all was in ruin. "I wish Merry was here," he heard himself saying, and quick thoughts raced through his mind, even as he watched the enemy come charging to the assault. "Well, well, now at any rate I understand poor Denethor a little better. We might die together, Merry and I, and since die we must, why not? Well, as he is not here, I hope he'll find an easier end. But now I must do my best." He drew his sword and looked at it, and the intertwining shapes of red and gold and the flowing characters of Numenor glinted like fire upon the blade. This was made for just such an hour, he thought. If only I could smite that foul messenger with it, then almost I should draw level with old Mary. Well, I'll smite some of this beastly brood before the end. I wish I could see cool sunlight and green grass again.
Then, even as he thought these things, the first assault crashed into them. The orcs, hindered by the mires that lay before the hills, halted and poured their arrows into the deafening ranks. But through them there came striding up, roaring like beasts, a great company of hill trolls out of Gorgoroth. Taller and broader than men they were, and they were clad only in loose-fitting mesh of horny scales. Or maybe that was their hideous hide. But they bore round bucklers, huge and black, and wielded heavy hammers in their knotted hands. Reckless they sprang into the pools and waded across, bellowing as they came. Like a storm they broke upon the line of men of Gondor, and beat upon helm and head, and arm and shield, as smiths hewing the hot bending iron. At Pippin's side, Beorgund was stunned and overborne, and he fell. And the great troll chief that smote him down bent down over him, reaching out a clutching claw, for these fell creatures would bite the throats of they that they threw down. Then Pippin stabbed upwards, and the written blade of Westernus pierced through the hide and went deep into the vitals of the troll, and his black blood came gushing out. He toppled forward and came crashing down like falling rock, bearing those beneath him. Blackness and stench of and crushing pain came upon Pippin, and his mind fell away into a great darkness.
So it ends as I guessed it would, his thought said, even as it fluttered away, and it laughed a little within him ere it fled. Almost gay it seemed, casting off at last all doubt and care and fear. And then, even as it winged away into forgetfulness, it heard voices, and they seemed to be crying in some forgotten world far above. The eagles are coming! The eagles are coming! For one moment more, Pippin's thought hovered. Bilbo, it said. But no. That came in his tale long, long ago. This is my tale, and it is ended now. Goodbye. And his thought fled far away, and his eyes saw no more.
Oh, what an end. What an end. All right, so at the end there, reminiscent of the Battle of Five Armies, right?
Because Eagles show up.
Well, we don't know if they actually showed up. But Bilbo gets knocked out early in the battle, just like how Pippin's getting knocked out here. Then again, Pippin might be dying. Like, this troll's falling on him. You could easily, like, suffocate here after he gets knocked out, right? Potentially, the eagles are showing up, but this might just be a fanciful vision that Pippin's having. That's the thing. True. But if it is the eagles, to end the show, Clifford, what do the eagles symbolize most? Symbolize, not the functional thing, this you know, this stupid that we will maybe have to address at some point. What do the eagles symbolize?
Divine providence?
Yeah, what's a token's word?
Eucatastrophe.
Ho ho ho. All right, let's end it there. Oh my gosh, now I got problems? Alright, fine. Now it's finally going. It's going. Alright.
should I
restart? No, it's fine. I'll be able to talk. Okay. Alright, Clifford. This is the end of book 5. It's chapter 10. We're done with that one. Phew
indeed. Yeah.
So unfortunately, I've been hauling to get these edited so fast, and I've got so much other stuff going on that I did not get time to send everything to Morgan to have her pick. So I think it's whoever won the epic reading contest of book 5 will remain a mystery forever, lost in infamy.
So. Going lost in history.
So I don't know.
Maybe any committed listeners, feel free to vote.
Right.
Via. I don't know how you would vote. Email address?
Yeah, or, I don't know.
Instagram?
Yeah, Instagram might be the best. I don't know. We don't really check any social media too much, honestly. Clifford and I are pretty bad. Plus, like, we're both busy. So.
Vote for yourself. Keep it to yourself.
So anyways, we're, like, pretty far into book 6 recording stuff, so just expect those episodes soon and quick. Like, we're just gonna roll through it, and we're gonna try to wrap this podcast up by summer, I guess.
Exciting.
Should be exciting. So yeah, don't even expect like too long of a break between here. We got a special episode coming up. We're doing Tolkien's, what was the story that we did? Leaf by Niggle. That was it. You remember that one? It was a while ago at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we mm-hmm. actually had to make a rare correction, like at least insert something that we screwed up or I screwed up, not Clifford, but yeah, it's, I don't know. Anyways, look for all that stuff. We got another big one to record tonight, so we could probably just leave it here. Clifford, how's things going with life though?
Pretty good. Might be moving this summer. We'll see. Ooh, yeah. Grad school's on the horizon.
Oh crap. That's another thing we got to talk about is when I'm going to visit you. All right. We got to plan that later. Yeah, okay, I have thoughts. We'll plan this after we're done recording. So, okay. All right, if you don't have anything else, let's just end it.
Sounds good. Okay. Thanks, y'all.